Compliment, huh?
Kim.
Oh, there he is.
Yeah, he usually sits over here.
I'm thinking he's not here.
I understand that. We have to help the team.
Jonathan, are you guys here? Are you? Well, I'm thank you. Hi, so you want to go first?
What are you doing over here?
Pissing up.
The Senator Kripler here is a little calm, even though she's at the...
I can put Adder in when she comes in.
Call the Administrative Rules Committee to order. Please do the roll call.
Representatives Devlin?
Here.
Beening? Boshi?
Here.
Ransbog? B. Koppelman? K. Koppelman?
Here.
Owens?
Here.
Schatz?
Here.
Silbernagle?
Here.
Thorson? Tolman?
Here.
Weiss? Senators Armstrong?
Here.
Heckerman?
Here.
Klein?
Here.
And Triplett?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Vanette. The consideration of the March 6th minutes. Senator Klein. Second. Second by Representative Boucher. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. The, we'll start the 10:05 with Vanette. Are you ready? Presentation by the Representative of the State Health Department regarding their minutes, which is on pages 1 through 28 of your book. Darlene, you must be going to do this, so go ahead.
Is that on now? Okay, thank you. My name is Darlene Bartz, and I am the Section Chief for the Health Resources Section with the North Dakota Department of Health. And I'm here to provide testimony relating to the proposed rules related to the general standards for construction and equipment for basic care facilities and optional end-of-life care for amendments to sections of the basic care requirements and also repeal of the general building requirements. First I want to ask, does everybody have a set of handouts now? Okay. You should have three sets. First, my testimony. Second, the summary of public comments. And then the third one is the regulatory analysis. So you should have like three sets of handouts there. So what we did is respond to the questions, and so I'll go over the responses to the questions as follows. Number one, the requested rule changes did not result from statutory changes made by the Legislative Assembly. The rule changes were made based on requests from the industry and the public and to update to reflect current standards. Two, the rule changes are not currently related to changes in federal statute. However, we anticipate there will be changes in the federal statute in the future related to nursing facility and hospitals consistent with the proposed changes. Three, a public notice of intent to hold a public hearing on the rules identified above was sent out on December 2nd, 2014 to be placed in newspapers throughout the state. In addition, a copy of the public notice and the proposed rule changes were emailed to the regulated community, including the representative associations. A public hearing was held on January 21, 2015. Three individuals were present related to changes in basic care rules, and one written comment was received in support. Six individuals were present related to the basic care construction and equipment rules, and three written comments were received in support. Three individuals were present related to the nursing facility codes and standards rules, and one written comment was received in support. Six individuals were present related to the hospital's codes and standards rules, and 3 written comments were received in support. The period for written comments closed on February 2nd, 2015. All written and oral comments were carefully considered. The rules were reviewed by the Office of the Attorney General and adopted by the State Health Council. Number 4, written and oral comments received were fully considered by the department with regards to these rules, and changes were made as deemed appropriate. No overall objections or complaints were received during the comment period. A summary of the comments, department response, and recommended changes is attached. 5, the approximate cost of giving public notice and review for legality by the Attorney General's office was approximately $2,100, and this does not include staff time from the department. 6, the proposed rule changes result in more current standards being applied for construction and remodeling of basic care facilities, hospitals, and nursing facilities in North Dakota, adds definitions to the basic care facilities rules for end-of-life care and secured units or facilities, provides an option for basic care facilities to provide end-of-life care to residents if they meet the specified requirements, and provides for posting of findings related to compliance of basic care facilities on the department's website. 7. A regulatory analysis consistent with North Dakota Century Code Section 28-32-08 was prepared and is attached for your review. Number 8, a small entity regulatory analysis and economic impact statement was as required by North Dakota Century Code 28-32-08.1 were completed and are attached for your review. 9, it is not anticipated that these rules will have a fiscal impact on our state revenues or expenditures, including funds controlled by the department. Therefore, no fiscal note has been attached. 10, a takings assessment was not required as the rules do not result in a takings in the context of North Dakota Century Code Section 28-32-09. And number 11, these rules were not adopted as emergency interim final rules under North Dakota Century Code Section 28-32-03. And that concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you have.
Darlene, could you just go into a little more specifics? I know you gave a basic answer on number 6, but a little more specifics, kind of what the regulated community should be expecting under these rules. I mean, what are the major changes for them? And quickly going through their comments and so on, I feel that you reacted to them well, but I think we'd like a little bit more of an explanation, if you would, please.
Yeah. Yes, I can go ahead and do that. If you want to refer to your pages in your manual, starting with page 3 in your manual. What you will see there is a new section being added to the basic care rules, which is optimal. Oh, and I don't know, John or Bennett, that should be optional instead of optimal. Is that something that you can change before it goes out? Okay. It should be optional end-of-life services. And then what we did is we put in a definition, which if you would go to page 5, we did define end-of-life care. It means a program of palliative or supportive care for a resident with a physician or nurse practitioner's order identifying a terminal illness or condition with a limited prognosis of 6 or fewer months to live that has elected to receive hospice services through a licensed and Medicare-certified hospice agency. Currently, individuals who would be receiving end-of-life care would need to be transferred to a skilled facility for that care. And so what this would do is allow them to stay in what they consider their home setting if the facility was able to meet some of the requirements for safety and for provision of the care and services. So this is actually a new service that would be allowed in basic care if they meet the requirement. And we've had a lot of requests from the industry that they feel that they would be able to provide that care. So that is definitely a new service that we would be able to provide to the people of North Dakota. You will see in there that under medication administration, we did add a little bit of language there where medication administration means an act in which a drug or biological is given to a resident by an individual who is authorized in accordance with state laws and regulation governing such acts. And then we put who that may include. It may include the licensed healthcare practitioner, which would be your physician, nurse practitioner, your PA, or licensed nurse, which would be your RNs and LPNs, and then medication assistants. And there are three levels of medication assistants in the state. So it specifies who would be providing that service. Basic care is the only facility type other than skilled nursing care that can have secured units for dementia care, and that is by statute. We didn't have that defined in our rule, and so what we did do is add that definition for clarity as to what is a secured unit and what is a secured facility. So you'll see that on the bottom of page 5 and on the top of page 19.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before you leave this definition, Ms. Bartz, I'd just like to ask a couple quick questions. And I appreciate your explanation and the Chairman's request for it, because reading these in a vacuum, it's hard to, and frankly, even with your written report, it's hard to know really what you're driving at and what the regulated community's response might be. But as I look, and I applaud the effort to keep people in their communities in many cases and so on, if that's what they elect to do. Your definition here of 6 or fewer months to live, I'm wondering if that's going to be, it's very tough, as you well know, for the medical community to be definitive about how much time people have left to live when they near the end of life. I think of some friends of ours, for example, who recently, her mother was, I think, given an expectation of maybe 6 months to live and live for 2 years, you know, so that can certainly happen. Do you think, I guess my question is, I realize you have to draw a line somewhere, perhaps. On the other hand, is this too definitive a statement, and will it drive healthcare providers to start simply mouthing those words, saying 6 or fewer months for the purpose of allowing for this sort of thing? Or could there be something more general, like in the opinion of medical professionals, a short time to live, or something like that? Or is that too generic in your view?
Representative Koppelman and members of the committee, basically that definition is one that's going to be consistent with hospice, Medicare certified hospice, okay, licensed hospice, and all of those. And so it actually is a very defined definition, okay, that we really can't change.
Understand. All right. Thank you.
And I would also agree with you that there's many instances that people live beyond that.
Sure. Well, if I might continue, Mr. Chairman, just the other part of that, then, I guess, that I was wondering about is it does specify hospice, and I think we all know they do great work, but is it a requirement that hospice be involved? It appears to be, in order for this to happen, and if so, why?
Representative Koppelman and members of the committee, basically what they want to provide is end-of-life care, which then goes into skilled nursing facility care, and so then they need that added resource in there to be caring for those people. They actually will be the ones, which you'll see later on in here, that will be providing the oversight for the care plan and the care that's being delivered to that individual as they decline.
Okay.
And with basic care, it is actually supposed to be a social model, and as a social model, what that says to you is that they should be needing assistance with their activities of daily living and not total care in any activities, mm-hmm, of daily living. And when you get to the point of requiring end-of-life care, and you are on hospice, the intent is that acknowledgement that you will decline and ultimately need total assistance.
Mm-hmm.
So they provide that oversight related to the skilled nursing care and so forth that would take place that normally a basic care facility could not provide.
So thank you. And so I know hospice is a very, as I said earlier, just a phenomenal program. I think any of us who have experienced it or had any contact with it really has high regard and great respect for it. But there are people who, for whatever reason, elect not to be part of hospice. What happens to those people?
Representative Koppelman, members of the committee, what would happen in that case is that they would follow the regular process in basic care, and that's when their care would deteriorate to the point where they're no longer able to just require assistance, but they're needing total care. Then they would wind up being transferred to a skilled nursing facility.
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, Darlene, on page 5, section 13, that isn't changing their scope of practice in any way. It's just clarifying that they're able to do this in this setting. Is that what you're saying?
Representative Sullivan, members of the committee, that would be correct.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no other, you can proceed.
So we did add those definitions for secured facility and secured unit. Those definitions are very similar to what we have, like also in our skilled nursing facilities, because it is basically identifying a locked unit. I will say that we anticipate in January of 2016 probably getting a work group together to start looking at, defining exactly changes in services for skilled units, but right now we felt the best part or secured units, but right now we felt the important part was to have the definitions in. We did add significant medication error. I will say to you that that was added in the definitions as a result of public comment. They asked that we would define what we considered a significant medication error, and so we did add that definition, and the industry was pleased with that addition. Then as far as the changes in the issue of license, because we created a separate chapter, which you will see, for the codes and standards for basic care facilities, we needed to reference this because both chapters then would relate to issuance of the basic care license. Then moving on to page, I think we'll take you to page 8. On page 8, number 6, it says the department shall make available to the public on the department's website the deficiency statement and accepted plan of correction following verification of correction. Right now, those documents are releasable, but they aren't accessible by the public without requesting it from us. We did have a private citizen who contacted our office before we went into rulemaking, and he was very concerned that we weren't making that information public, and so there was no reason it shouldn't be public, but we put it in regulation then to provide that clarification. And more and more, we will want to be making our work with the facilities transparent, and so we could see this going on through other programs too. Right now, our skilled nursing facility deficiency statements, federal deficiency statements, are posted, and I think we have like up to 5 years on, so this would be starting now with another program that we would be posting those citations. Then next I'll have you turn to page 11. And on page 11, you're going to see two changes. On E, at the top half of the page, we've added the words "to the department." Just to clarify, because we have the CNA registry and the nurse aid registry for the state of North Dakota, and if there are any findings of resident abuse, neglect, or misappropriation of resident property by those individuals, that does need to come into the department. And so we wanted to clarify that that would be reported to us. And then in F on that page, we also put in the reporting of significant medication errors. And based on public comment, we did change that to read in accordance with state law, so that if it was like an RN or an LPN who made the significant medication error, state law would require that to be reported to the Board of Nursing rather than to the Department of Health. And so we wanted it to go specific to that practice committee. So that was why that was written in that manner. As far as the medication errors made by the medication assistant 1 or 2, they are on the Department of Health's registry, so they would come into us. Then if you go to page 12, you're going to see a lot of deleted lines. We did keep the heading there, just to tie it in, the fire safety part, but we did create a separate chapter so that we modeled the same approach that we have for skilled nursing facilities and hospitals of having our health section and then our codes and construction section, so two different chapters in the rules. So that the content there was basically moved, as was on the bottom of page 12, you see the deletion in the general building requirements. That was repealed from this section, and you'll see that come up in the next section. Starting on page 15, we have the optional end-of-life services. And we had formed a work group which existed of several members from the industry, Shelley Peterson, someone from the Attorney General's office, the state ombudsman, people from both, representing both hospice and long-term care, and had several meetings to discuss what optional end-of-life services should look like in North Dakota in our facilities. And so after working with that work group significantly, we prepared this. And I think it's a very workable set of guidance for the facilities as to what would need to take place to provide end-of-life care. And you know, what it covers is that they would have to apply to provide that service, because it would because they're going to be having skilled nursing facility patients in reality in a basic care facility, which is a social model, then there's a need to ensure their safety. So we have the requirement for a sprinkler system. We have you know, the need to be looking at the E-score, so to make sure if there was a fire that the individuals would be able to evacuate. That contract with the hospice agencies, so that they would have someone who would know how to provide that end-of-life care, directing that care and services, and talking about staff education that the staff would need to know to provide that higher level of care. Ultimately, the care of a hospice resident in a basic care facility does remain the responsibility of the basic care facility, because by statute they are required to meet the needs of the resident. So if they keep the resident, they need to meet the needs. So that's basically what you're going to see in that section. And we got a lot of positive feedback from the industry on that. Then on page...
Darlene, if I may interrupt, we may be getting a little more specific than the chairman intended. Maybe at this point I'll ask the committee if there was any questions on the rest of the rules instead of her having to go in through each section as she's doing now. Senator Klein.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just another point of, I don't know, maybe clarification for me. On page 15 and under number 2, when it lists the probably the fifth line, the facility must employ a licensed nurse, etc., and respond to resident needs. Is that care plan accordingly or plan care accordingly? I just thought it read kind of different. I wasn't sure if that was just if that's the way it's supposed to be.
Representative Klein, that would be the way it's supposed
okay.
to be. Yep.
Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a few questions, if I might. Ms. Bartz, I was looking at on page 11 also, the new language there on letter F, where it talks about reporting a significant medication error to officials in accordance with law, and then it says that any error like that shall be reported to the Department of Health. Do you know what happens after that? Are they empowered to police that sort of thing, or?
Representative Koppelman and members of the committee, yes, the Department of Health is the regulatory body for the medication assistance 1 and 2. Okay. So then we would be able to investigate that complaint and take whatever disciplinary action is necessary for those individuals.
Okay, thank you. And then along the same lines, I guess, of referring to or working with other agencies, I noticed getting into this fire safety issue, I noticed back on page 6 is the first occurrence of a reference to that I saw, where you deleted the language in item 3 that says the department may request the assistance of the state fire marshal in this inspection. Does that imply then that the department is going to do fire inspections, or are you equipped to do that? How does that work?
Representative Koppelman, members of the committee, that work has been transferred to the Department of Health, and so that's just cleanup.
So the Department of Human Services doesn't do that, the Department of Health does that?
Department of Health does that.
Is there any reference to that, or?
If you go back further into the regulations here, let me just see, basic care.
You don't have to cite it, I was just curious if it's...
On page 18, you start with the general standards of construction and equipment for basic care, and if you move through that on page 21, that's where that was moved, and it's specific then, like, to the Department of Health.
Okay, thank you. And then a couple other real quick questions on this fire safety issue. I was noticing in the language on page 16, and I believe, looking at what was deleted earlier, this is an update from a 2008 version, and we, I think, on this committee all realize you can't adopt some other code or reference without, in general, and then expect it to be embraced as it changes, but you have to specify a static or specific animal, which is apparently what's happening here as you talk about the 2012 edition. But maybe help me with this a little bit. What is, I don't know what the National Fire Protection Association is, nor what their standards are. Are they a federal government entity? Are they a standalone private association? Where are they?
If I may, I'm going to defer to Monty Engel to address that question. He is the division director for life safety and construction.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee and Representative Koppelman. The National Fire Protection Association. Monty Engel, division director for life safety and construction with the State Health Department. The National Fire Protection Association is an association. It's not a government affiliated, primarily designed to develop, their whole mission is fire safety and developing standards.
Okay.
For fire safety.
And yes, Mr. Engel, thank you. And I guess my question about that is, you know, this committee has dealt with issues in the past relating to building codes, fire codes, other kinds of things where the sort of the knee-jerk reaction has just been, well, just adopt the newest, best of whatever someone else said who's supposed to know something about this. And the problem is, as we drill down into that and we see what industries may have to say and maybe what even other states are doing, we find that sometimes, you know, some of the organizations that represent a particular interest have, you know, maybe go overboard or do some things that are unnecessary for our state. I guess I'm just wondering, you know, what is magic about the 2012 version versus the 2008 version that we need to embrace? Is it more restrictive? We all believe in public safety. We all want to have fire safety, but I don't know what this is.
Representative Koppelman, members of the committee, the NFPA, National Fire Protection Association, is a consensus organization, so they have membership from all industries represented on their committees. So it's a consensus code adopted by the federal government for most facilities that they regulate. It's historically been used for basic care already and long-term care hospitals.
So, and maybe, I don't know if you or Darlene can answer this, but was there any concern by the regulated community? Do they know what this means? Is this going to involve them being required to install a bunch more sprinklers or retrofit their facilities? Or, you know, I have no way to get a handle on what's happening here, I guess.
Now, Koppelman, members of the committee, the life safety code, which is the NFPA 101, the 2012, is on a mandatory renewal basis through NFPA every 4 years. And so the codes react to fire situations which have occurred. So, I mean, it's a reactionary code. If you remember the MGM fire in Las Vegas, code changes resulted after that fire investigation. So basically they take a look at fires which have occurred, look at the code, is there anything the code can do to prevent that from occurring in the future, and so they model their code after fire situations which have occurred. So every evolution of the particular addition has the potential to get more restrictive in certain areas and more lenient in other areas as you know, history of fire basically, you know, progresses and we learn about it.
Have you ever seen it become more lenient? As I look at these things, I usually see them ramp up. But
Representative Koppelman, yes, there has been a number of leniency changes, if you will, in the code over the years, yes.
Thank you.
The only other comment I would add to Monty's is that we did move forward to the 2012 code for these three entities based on the request of the industry.
Are there any other questions from the committee on any of these rules? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darlene, why do we need these rules about the optimum care, our end-of-life care? I mean, aren't we getting along just fine the way we are right now? I guess what I'm afraid of is we're peeing ourselves in a corner, and then we increase our costs, you know, to the people.
Representative Schatz and members of the committee, again, those are coming forth based on requests of the industry and actually, I would say, requests of the families who have loved ones in those facilities. There's really a trauma to not only the resident but the family when they've lived someplace for maybe 10 years or more and they're looking at potentially dying in the near future and needing to relocate at that very traumatic point in life. And so I think the consensus has been by all that this would be a really good option to provide. The other thing we did do when we met as a work group is we also met with Department of Human Services to talk about, you know, how that could be incorporated and paid for. And so they had come up with some suggestions on that.
Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple more quick questions, and I apologize for monopolizing the questioning here. But, Ms. Bartz, on page 16, the very top item there, number 6, it talks about the facility being required to notify the department within 48 hours of anyone who basically requests hospice, as I read it. What business is that of the state, and what purpose is there for the reporting? Are you developing a registry of everybody that's electing for a hospice?
Representative Koppelman, members of the committee, the reason for that is because there's certain requirements then that need to start being implemented within the facility when they have somebody who is requiring hospice. For example, they would need to evaluate for the E-scores or the evacuation scores that take place of all of the residents in their facility. And with that, it would change their staffing and then also the expectations as far as care. So it lets us know that there's a change that's going on in the facility and giving us an awareness for that oversight.
So if you need that for your oversight, which is, I guess, understandable, generic, numeric report, or is this something where they say John Jones has now signed up for hospice, Mary Smith has now signed up for hospice, and if that's the case, why is that necessary, rather than facility A has three new hospice patients with a life expectancy of 6 months or less?
Representative Koppelman, our intent is that we would actually get the name of the individual so that we would know who that is. I will say that we did a significant amount of research before this was drafted and before this was put together, and that is a model that we're seeing implemented in other states and how they're working with it. You know, and that does give us a little bit of guidance as far as like looking at the facility. I can't say that I'm really thinking that it would trigger us surveying them any more frequently or anything like that, but it is necessary to have that information just so that we know, you know, what is happening in that facility, because it is providing skilled nursing care, which is actually a different level of care than what they are authorized by state law to do. And so we are giving them that ability to keep that specific resident at a higher level of care than the others in the facility.
Let me ask you one question about that. I don't know what the rest of the committee feels. I personally have a real concern about gathering that kind of information as a requirement and don't really see the need. I think you could do it in other ways. if it were to, and this is really an important policymaking issue as I see it, if the, it would be the mood of the committee, or if the committee has some concern about that, would your preference be that if you were given one of two choices, that either that be voided or removed from the rule, or would your preference be that you somehow have the opportunity to rewrite it in a more generic way without requiring names and, you know, intruding on individuals' privacy, if you will? Or would just doing away with it be a better option for the department?
Well, you know, I, Representative Compliment, members of the committee, I do think it's an important piece, and so I would hate to see that go away.
Understand.
I will tell you, too, even when you look at federal regulation related to HIPAA privacy rules, we are not asking for anything that isn't actually covered in HIPAA, too, that as a regulatory agency, we do have the right to look at everybody in the facility and the operation of the facility. So, I mean...
HIPAA says they can't tell anyone... anyone in the world about people's private health information except government. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the regulatory and public health are two separate provisions that are in the HIPAA privacy rule, and that is for us to be able to ensure safety. And I guess the big consideration with this is that the care needs of that person and the safety needs of that person really significantly change when they go into this status. And so if we don't know who it is that is needing these extra care and you know, be able to work with the facility on that, then that puts us at a disadvantage as far as doing what actually you guys have asked us to do, and that's to ensure the safety and care that's being provided to those people.
Sure, and I trust that we also trust the facilities to do mm-hmm. that to a great extent, as I hope you do, but appreciate your defense of your mm-hmm. proposed rule, but I would like and answer my question, if you had to choose between either that item being voided or it being modified to allow you to collect generic information somehow for the purposes you've explained, which may be very understandable, what would you prefer?
You know, if it's a matter of removing it or making it more generic, I would like to have it more generic.
Thank you.
Yes.
And then, Mr. Chairman, if I might, one unrelated last question that I have is, and this might seem like a silly thing, but on page 22, bottom of the page, you get so specific in some of these areas, and I don't know if there's a federal requirement that you do this or if it's just driven by a desire to be thorough, but, you know, it talks about a minimum of one clean, comfortable pillow in every room. I mean, does that imply that there can be two, that one can be dirty and uncomfortable? Or is that, I mean, isn't that getting a little bit...
Well. Representative Compliment, members of the committee, you know, I've worked with actually the basic care program for probably 25 years, and honestly, some of these requirements were in the old rules and came forward. And I will tell you that sometimes we've had issues with people even getting the minimum. They'll come with nothing.
Really?
And so, you know, there's a certain level that you really want the facility to make sure that person has. And all I'm saying is that we really want them to have at least one.
Understand. All right. Thank you.
Another question?
Mr. Chairman, not a question, but a comment. Frankly, I feel pretty comfortable with the rules as proposed and would be encouraged to see them move forward.
Thank you. Is there any other questions of Darlene from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone here from the regulated community that wanted to comment on these? Seeing none, we'll move on to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Glenn Jackson, Director of the Driver's License Division. To make this fairly quick, I won't go through all of the steps we complied with in the Legislative Council's letter. Essentially, what this change does, we had a case last year where we had an individual who, through a medical issue, did not lose consciousness. but because the medical community said he shouldn't drive, we suspended his driving privileges. He came back and said, well, you can't do that because I didn't lose consciousness, and your rules say that it has to be a loss of consciousness. We took it to the medical review board, which consists of neurosurgeons, psychiatrists, psychologists, ophthalmologists, optometrists, medical association, etc. They reviewed the case of the individual, and their conclusion was because he did experience an altered state of consciousness, unconsciousness was not necessary. And they proposed we change these rules to delete the requirement to demonstrate lack of consciousness and just leave the conditions themselves, which we agreed with, and that's the substance of the rule. I'd answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Triplett?
The microphone cord, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, and I lost your name already, I'm sorry.
Lynn Jackson.
Okay, Mr. Jackson. Can you describe altered state of consciousness and how that came about and how you know about it and how many other people might suffer from similar altered states of consciousness?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, the altered state of consciousness came through self-reporting of the individual and concurrence of the observation with his neurologist. So it was a reported condition. He did not lose consciousness, but he did experience a condition based upon his physical conditioning that did alter his ability to effectively understand what he was seeing and what he was doing. And the physician deemed that sufficient information to say he should not drive or be on the highway. And we concurred. As far as the numbers, it's all reported through the medical community self-reported, and I couldn't tell you how many of those we actually would have.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue.
You may continue.
Does this, so it was related to some kind of symptomology, like unrelated to the use of drugs and alcohol, for example. It wasn't an altered state of consciousness induced by the use of drugs. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tribble, that's correct. It has nothing to do with drugs. This is a medical condition, a neurological condition that occurred in the individual.
Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your concise report. Is there any comment from anyone in the audience here today on these rules? Seeing none, we'll move on to the State Board of Plumbing.
Yeah, exactly.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brent Beachy. I'm the Secretary and Chief Inspector of the North Dakota State Plumbing Board. My office manager, Kimberly Tomonic, is with me today. Basically, we just had a couple of quick changes to our law, just a quick rundown. It was not a statute change made by the Legislative Assembly.
I think you could move right on to number six, unless you're going to tell us that there was that the legislature had made a change or there was federal regulation change. If not, we're fine. So why don't you go in and explain the rules in section six?
Okay. Basically, they both came about our 2009 Uniform Plumbing Code that we've adopted. It kind of jumps around the requirements for certain fixtures that are in different parts of the code, makes it very difficult for like county district health units to enforce the requirements for fixtures because it's kind of gray. Requirements for water supply and proper sewage disposal, it all kind of came about because of the issue out in Leaf, North Dakota. So we decided, okay, let's just kind of conglomerate all of this And you'll find that, I believe, on page 44. Kimberly actually went to get copies for you guys, but you should have those changes on page 44. And basically that talks about requirements for proper sewage disposal, proper water supply, and fixtures. 39, okay. I actually gave her two of my copies because she was going to run a copy off for everybody, but she didn't know that you guys already had it, so. 39, actually, on page 39 is going to be the other rule change that we made. And basically what that does is, in our law book right now, there's several entities who could be the authority having jurisdiction for private sewage disposal systems. And I can read those off to you. There's several of them. Could be North Dakota State Department of Health, could be the North Dakota State Plumbing Board, District Health Units, county or city health departments which have expertise in on-site sewage treatment systems, or individual official, board, department, or agency established and authorized by a state, county, city, or other political subdivision created by law to enforce this chapter. Now, the North Dakota State Plumbing Board, we've never had anything to do with septic tanks and drain fills before, and once again, it kind of made it difficult for Custer Health, for example. They felt they had to come to us and get our permission relating back to that lease issue, once again. And we said, well, really, you know, we are on there, but we really have nothing to do with it. We don't permit these guys. We don't inspect them. We don't have continuing education for them. So we simplified things and opened it up better for these county and district health units. And we'd like to strike our name off of that list of authorities having jurisdiction in reference to private sewage disposal systems.
Senator Heckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brent, on that same area then, so how do I know in my community who is in charge then if it says or? Who do I call? Who do I find out?
Most people actually usually call the state health department anyway. If they do call our office, we'll say, well, it's going to be Custer District Health Unit in your area, or it's going to be Southwest District Health Unit or Upper Missouri District Health Unit. If it's somebody we don't know, then we actually will actually reference them to the state health department, and then they help them from there.
You may continue. Thank you. So does the state health department assign that authority for everybody, or do all of these just basically have it because it's listed in here?
Yes. The state health department has no jurisdiction whatsoever in private sewage disposal systems, but they are kind of a general area where everybody turns to. Of course, there's been legislation, even just this last year also, where they would kind of like to have the state health department run that program on a statewide basis. That did not go through, however. You know, and there are counties out there too, like Fargo Cass. They do their own septic tank and drain fields, but then you get guys like Lake Region out of Devil's Lake. They do several counties.
Further questions? Seeing none, I think we're good. Is there anybody in the audience from the regulated community who wanted to testify on these rules? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take a quick 10-minute break. Department of Human Services, I'll have them at 11. So, just thank you. committee, we will come back to order. We will move on to the Department of Health. Julie, I believe, Department of Human Services, excuse me. Julie, are you going to do it, or Mr. Fleming, you're going to do it? Okay.
I'll start if I need backup. Jim, yeah. Jim and Paulette are here for me.
If there's no questions from the committee on 1 through 5, I'm just going to have Julie move right on to 6 to explain what the proposal does. Let me do that. Fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Julie Neer. I'm an attorney with the Department of Human Services. These are the rules that are required for the Child Support Division to do every 4 years. They do a guidelines review. I'm going to do a little peremptory answer to a question I received earlier. There are still 2 legislative members on that review committee. So the rules, if you begin on page 2 of my testimony, under paragraph 6, the proposed rules made changes to the definitions of gross income and net income. Those changes are discussed in some detail. We also did receive 1 set of comments, and the comments were actually from the division on things that had come up in additional review. So we made a couple of other clarifying changes based on some of the input that they had received. So one of the clarifications was in this section where we talk about the section was changed further to clarify the deduction for mileage expense and to clarify the documentation requirement. The second section that was amended in these rules was 7502.04.105, and that is a section on determination of net income from self-employment. It was amended to set forth conditions under which an obligor can offset self-employment income with self-employment losses from another business. Again, this one had had some changes made pursuant to comments. We had language in there that talked about the state's average earnings, and we were concerned that the states might be ambiguous depending upon where the obligor or the obligee lived. So we wanted to make sure that it was clarified that we're talking about North Dakota provisions, and so that's been changed to read this state's average earnings. In section 7502.04.107, the section dealing with imputing income based on earnings capacity, we made several amendments to that section. It updates the exceptions to imputing income. It extends the look-back period from 24 months to the current partial calendar year and the 2 previous full calendar years. It establishes a methodology for imputing income when an obligor is both a minor and has a disability, or is both incarcerated and has a disability. And it changes the imputation provisions for an obligor who fails to provide income information in a proceeding to establish child support. Again, we had changes made pursuant to the comments. And the changes were to clarify when income may not be imputed to an incarcerated obligor, and to clarify that statewide average earnings refers to North Dakota statewide average earnings. The section 7502.04.108.1 is the section on adjustments for extended parenting time. And this was amended to clarify that extended parenting time is not authorized when the parents have equal residential responsibility. Section 7502.04.108.2 is the section on equal residential responsibility and determination of child support obligation. And this was amended to expand the current rule regarding equal physical custody to include those cases where some but not all of the siblings are shared equally. The next section that we amended was the section for the criteria for rebuttal of guideline amount. That section 7502.04.109. And this was amended to specify that a deviation for a high-income obligor must be based on demonstrated needs of the child, and also to increase the amount that is considered to be high income from $12,500 to $25,000 per month. It also, we also made changes to address an obligor's reduced ability to provide support when they're maintaining 2 households because they're in the military or on a temporary duty assignment. The final changes that we made were to clarify how deviation must be applied in cases involving split or equal residential responsibility. And again, pursuant to the comments, we made changes to clarify what's included in demonstrated needs of the child. The final section of the rules that we amended was the child support amounts table, and that was to increase the table of presumptively correct child support amounts to include monthly increments of up to $25,000. There is a estimated fiscal impact, and that is $69,367, $20,185 of that is general fund. That's for IT changes that are required to implement the rules, and these rules are not being adopted as emergency. That's all I have. If anybody has any questions or...
Question from the committee or Senator Heckman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Julie, on the part with the lodging expense and the mileage, it's listed in here as a specific dollar amount, and that never stays the same from one year to the next, or from one when the mileage is 56 cents. Was there any thought of putting in like state rate or federal rate or IRS rate or?
Jim would love to come up.
Or is it good just to put it the way it is? I'm sure there's a reason. I just wanted to.
I will let him respond okay. Because I.
And then I have a question on the numbers in the back too.
Thank you, Julie. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Fleming, the Child Support Director. These rules are produced as by a Child Support Guidelines Advisory Committee that's set by Century Code, and it includes two legislators and a number of other people. We had three published public meetings. We got our work done before we got to number four, so we had three all-day meetings in the Capitol to talk about these changes, and that question has always come up in the Guidelines Committee. We have talked about incorporating by reference the state reimbursement rate. The feedback that we've received from the private attorney side has been then they don't just have to look at the guidelines to know what that number is, but then they got to go looking for the state reimbursement rate. Child support knows that really well because we're state employees, but that's the flip side. And so that is the reason why, despite the urge to not have to keep amending this every 4 years, that it says what it says.
And I have another question too.
Yeah, we appreciate.
On the rates in the back on the obligors, the monthly net income, I see some of the amounts have decreased slightly on the lower rates, on the lower incomes. And is there a formula that you use to get that information? And because as you go along, it seems to me those with a lower income pay a higher percentage than those with a higher income, or am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Heckman, you're right. Your observations are correct. I'm not seeing where we amended the lower income figures this time.
On page 67 in our book, I don't know what it is in yours, if they earn $10,200 net, it goes from 1731 down to 1730, 2894 down to 2857. I mean, there's some decreases in there.
I'm following you. I apologize. That actually meant the low income on the whole chart, and not the lower of the higher income.
The lower, some of the responsibility rates.
Right. What has happened over time? The original table capped at 10,000, and it was based on percentages. So even though they're expressed as a number here, they were expressed as a percentage, and it was kind of a bell curve. It always balanced the ability of low-income obligors to pay with what the kids need. And so the lower-income obligors started out lower, it went above as a percentage, and then it tapered off as a percentage over time. So the obligor who makes 9,000 net a month or 10,000 net is not, I mean, the percentage is going to change. So there's been that percentage. It's based on census data for the cost of raising kids. The proportion of household costs are not the same for a minimum wage obligor as they are for a higher obligor. So they capped at 10,000. Years ago, they grew the table from 10,000 to 12,500 and merely applied the same top percentage. Since we were expanding the table anyway, we went back and did a little bit deeper math on that and did more of a progression downward all the way to 25,000. I saw the looks in the faces when the about, you know, guideline amounts, monthly amounts of 25,000 or more. At the time the Guidelines Committee was meeting, there was a pending Supreme Court case where an obligor had done very well for himself post-divorce, and the court applied the percentage only. And so the same percentage to $10,000 on the table, well, this person makes $500,000 a month, or what, it was a very large number, and applied that raw percentage without looking at what the child's needs actually were. And I was asking my colleague Paulette, I think the monthly amount due from this obligor on an ongoing basis in child support was $47,000. It was reversed on appeal the day before we had our last meeting, so we were able to take that into account. But we tweaked the table here because the committee felt that at the point where you're talking about those high numbers, there really ought to be more than just a blind application of a percentage to income, but rather looking at somewhat, is there some reason the child needs that kind of money? And so that's where this is an unprecedented extension of the table. It was 10,000 for 20 years, then it went to 12,500, and now we've doubled it to 25,000. But we did that to try to accommodate for some of the growth in income is just really is surprising. And the same guidelines have to apply to everybody. So the ones that apply to the predominant part of the population are also applying to the ones who've got a lot of income.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for prolonging this by an extra minute, but this is just a question I'd like to know. In your description of the balancing act that you do on the bottom side, because obviously what the obligors pay in the lower levels, you know, doesn't even remotely meet the real needs of raising a child, and you're trying to make sure that those people don't starve to death while trying to do what they can, and I appreciate that. But where is the sort of break-even point right now in our current economy with your current statistics? You know, where is it that that the income of the obligor and the percentages that you're applying as child support really, like, are just right in terms of meeting the needs without being excessive, what you were just talking about with the 47,000 a month versus not being enough at the lower end? Where's the happy middle point right now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, there aren't numbers that tell us that. You know, it really is tough. You could have the kid living in an urban area in North Dakota or in Williston where housing costs are much higher. You could have me living in a rural area where housing is cheaper. There's just no real set of numbers where you can answer that.
One more time. What are the numbers that you are using for the current cost of raising one child per year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, we use the USDA census data regarding the cost of raising children in rural areas. That's what we use. Yes. Yes.
Can you tell me what that number is right now?
I can't now, but we could get you the table that we use.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Not a problem.
Further questions?
Is email all right?
Yes.
Okay.
As one of the legislators who has served on the Child Support Guideline Committee, I highly recommend it to each one of you at some point during a legislative career. Former Senator Fisher and I got to serve on that together. It was a very much of a learning experience. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you both. Is there any comment from anyone else in the audience on the rules that the Department of Human Services had before us today? Seeing none, thank you. Committee discussion and directives. Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one item I raised a question about in the Department of Health, I understand, and it's on, for reference, it's on page 16 at the top of the page, item number 6 there, regarding the notification by name of every person who has elected hospice care. I understand the need of the department to have this general information for doing their job for regulatory purposes to ensure that each facility is providing what they need to provide for the number of people they have on hospice care. What concerns me a little bit is, you know, in this day and age of health care information privacy for every other entity in the world, we're, you know, if this goes through as written, we are requiring healthcare and the divulging of healthcare information for this specific purpose. And it just occurs to me that there might be citizens that we represent who, you know, when making that emotional, very personal family decision of putting someone on hospice care, might prefer that be an anonymous tabulation versus a by name indication that, you know, mom is now on hospice care and the state government is being reported to the state. So, you know, I'm not interested in voiding that measure, but I guess what I would like is an opportunity to visit with the department a little bit about, you know, how that language might be wordsmithed just a bit to ensure a little more privacy. And so I would move that to just that item, just that number 6 on page 16 be held over for the next meeting so we can have an opportunity to do that.
The second was by Senator Triplin. Okay. Discussion from the committee. Darlene, do you have any thoughts on holding it over? I'm not so concerned about the Department of Health as I am, you know, the people involved in the facilities. I just wonder what your thoughts on holding this over.
Representative Devlin, members of the committee, is this on? Oh, okay. We already do have facilities calling us saying that they would like to be able to implement this right away. That would result in us needing to tell them that, you know, we would have to wait until the next Rules Committee before they would be able to keep those individuals in their facility. So, you know, that would be a delay in our ability to implement end-of-life care in basic care facilities. The other comment I would make is that when we did go through the rulemaking process, we were having representatives from the public, the Attorney General's office, the hospice centers, the basic care facilities. We had all of those, and all of them never had any concern with this whatsoever. The department currently is, via federal requirements, collecting data on every nursing facility resident, every hospice resident, many programs that we routinely get that information many times a year on every resident and facilities. And it's just part of what is available to us as that regulatory. So this would be outside the norm to do this versus consistent with, you know, what's going on in other programs and practices. Plus, it would delay our ability to allow facilities to implement.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you. Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bartz, I guess I'm a little confused as to why the delay of this one tiny item in the entire new. We're not talking about holding the entire rule over. I don't know if you understood that. We're just talking about this one item concerning reporting of names. Mm-hmm. So how would that prohibit the implementation of any of this?
A representative compliment. That's part of the overall, and so if we're holding back one piece of it, I'm not sure how we would go and implement the rest.
Well, over the years that the Ministry of Rules Committee has had the authority to hold a rule or a portion of a rule over for further consideration, agencies of government have routinely implemented the rule and then come back and discussed that particular item and dealt with that in whatever fashion, whether it ultimately is voted or amended or, you know. So I don't think I've ever encountered, and I've been in this committee for about 20 years now, I don't think I've ever encountered a situation where an agency said if you void a couple of words, the entire rule can't be implemented. So I'm confused.
Well, maybe I'm confused, but if we're holding it to come back to the future meeting, then are we implementing as is in the meantime and then bring it back? Or
Mr. Chairman, my understanding would be this entire rule would be in effect with the exception of just that item. So in other words, you could not require the facilities to give you the names of everyone going on hospice. You could still ask them for how many do you have, and you'd still be able to deal with your, and if they wanted to voluntarily tell you who they have, I don't see anything in law that would prohibit that either. It just is that you would not be authorized to require that until the committee deals with that little piece. But everything else here, you'd be implementing and working with.
Yeah. Is there any further discussion from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Koppelman's motion was to hold over section 6 on page
16,
if I put my glasses on, and it was seconded by, I believe, Senator Triplett. Poll the committee.
Representative Devlin?
No.
Boshi?
Yes.
Kim Koppelman?
Yes.
Owens? Is that a no? Thank you. Schatz? Schatz?
Yes.
Silbernagle?
No.
Tillman? Senators Armstrong?
No.
Heckman?
Yes.
Klein?
No.
Triplett? Motion carried.
Motion carried?
Yeah.
Motion carried. Section 6 will be held over till the next meeting. Any other discussion or directives for the committee? Seeing none, I want to thank you all for serving. I believe that this will be my last meeting as chairman. This normally rotates when we do the interim appointments, so I hope that you will all volunteer to be on the committee again. You've been a great group. You've asked meaningful questions, and it's a very important job we do here. I believe it's one of the most important, if not the most important, legislative committee, and I thank all of you for being part of it. I thank Vanette for stepping in and taking over ably for John, and John, I appreciate everything you've done for us, and I thank you all. Is there anything else?
Sure.
Reverend Koppelman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As some of us have sat in that chair, and I know we've done it more than once, I just want to compliment you for your very able and seasoned leadership, and it's been a good term. I always bristle a little bit when they call this an interim committee, because it's not. It's a statutory committee, but Representative Billman, you've done an excellent job as usual, and we appreciate it.
Anything else for the good of the group? We are adjourned.
It was not a motion.
It's not binding, but it's definitely.
I'll put it right up here.
All of the. This is a bit unusual.
Yeah,
we'll fix that.
And especially since it's fresh in here, so it's just easy to fix it.
Because this number is in the middle of the list, I think what we do is preserve the subsection 6 and delete the text
of mine.
Put in pending consideration, something like that. Just to reserve the space.
Yeah.
I don't get.
So I don't know if there's any cross references.
John, all of the rest of it will be public in the administrative code and blog on my website. There's a blank space basically where 6 is, but no mention.
I'll give you mine too. There we go. Okay. I guess they'll let me know if they need to.
Yeah, I'll worry about that. Okay,
every
thanks.
Other part of it will be suggested optimal, and there were a couple of tweaks in here. Just editorial. I would replace his or her with the residents with apostrophe S, just to get rid of the sexist pronouns.
Okay, well, yeah, I thought you were just going to continue on.
There's a his or her in another group. Oh, try to delete those out wherever they show up. Just because I hate them on the computer, so
I got voted for you.
We can leave it. It's just a pronouns. And then over here, it says the reporting to the Department of Health. All the way through this chapter, it's just a hard number. So we'll be talking about that. Just so help here doesn't confuse people, know what that one is.
Right. Does that make sense?
Who's there?
No, my point is, yeah, so what you're saying is we won't exceed.
Probably the 10th to the 15th of September. I thought you did.
We want you to get yourself to call.
I would just like to meet you, so we're... She's lucky every time.
Job security. It'll just be that one plus, you know, the optimal.
Excellent. That's kind of a good word.
Yeah, it is.
Maybe it should be optional.
Optimal.
End of life.
Yeah, I'd like my end of life to be optimal.
Right.
Actually, optional is probably good too. I choose not to. Josh, Tim Dawson sent a message out. If you could contact him before you leave, he has something for you. Okay. Okay, thanks.
It's probably a birthday present.
He was bothering me while I was trying to do minutes here.
I mean, on that level, yeah.
Thank you both very much for everything.
Thank you, Bill. Always a pleasure working with you, and you do a terrific job of this. You sure you can't get reappointed?
If they want to do it, I'm fine with it, but it's best to give you somebody else as a Senate person. You know?
I guess.
But if they don't do it.
There's a lot of politics, as you know. And it was never here. So, I know.
I'm just there, and you know, I'm in Hawaii.